The Pharisees went off and began to plot how they might trap Jesus in speech. They sent their disciples to him, accompanied by Herodian sympathizers, who said, "Teacher, we know you are a truthful man and teach God's way sincerely. You court no one's favor and do not act out of human respect. Give us your opinion then in this case. Is it lawful to pay tax to the emperor or not?" Jesus recognized their bad faith and said to them, "Why are you trying to trip me up, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the tax." When they handed him a small Roman coin, he asked them, "Whose head is this and whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. At that he said to them, "Then give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but give to God what is God's."
The episode of today's Gospel is one of the most quoted of all the famous episodes of our Lord's public life. The Pharisees, together with the scribes and chief priests, have realized that the parables Jesus has told are aimed at them. But much as they long to lay hands on him, their fear of the people holds them back for the moment. So they go off and plot how to trap him in what he says. But instead of confronting him themselves, they sent him their disciples, and with them Herodian sympathizers. The Herodians were not a religious party, but politically minded men who wanted the kingdom of Herod the Great restored to his son Herod Antipas. But they, unlike the Pharisees, who were fanatically nationalistic, bowed to Roman authority. They were useful then, on this occasion, to pose such a question as the lawfulness of paying tax to the emperor. On another occasion, too, the Pharisees had consulted with the Herodians how they might destroy him. It was when he healed the man with the withered hand on the Sabbath. As it took place in Galilee, which was Herod's territory, the Pharisees could not go ahead and destroy Jesus without the cooperation of the Herod party. They were convenient allies then. From my father's old Shorter Oxford Dictionary, I see that in Middle English, the term Herodian was one of reproach. "They jump with Caesar, like the Herodians," runs a quotation of 1592. Frank Sheed describes them bluntly as hecklers, and this they certainly were. St. Luke introduces this episode immediately after the parable of the wicked husbandmen of the vineyard. He writes,
"They realized that this parable was aimed at them, so they waited their opportunity and sent agents to pose as men devoted to the law and to fasten on something he might say, and so enable them to hand him over to the jurisdiction and authority of the governor."
The hecklers begin, as one writer puts it, with a loaded compliment.
"We know you are a truthful man and teach God's way sincerely. You court no one's favour and do not act out of human respect."
And then came the insidious question, was it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar? The tribute, or tax, had to be paid by every subject of the Roman Empire. But the Jews paid it very unwillingly. Apart from the natural human dislike of paying taxes, for them it was an odious sign of subjection to a foreign power, and pagan at that. It also meant calling into question the acknowledgement of Yahweh as the only sovereign. If he were to say yes, Jesus would be accused of betraying the Jewish people. If no, he could be handed over to Pontius Pilate and put to death. Our Lord avoided the trap, but asked to see a coin which was used for the tax. They showed him a silver coin with the image of the emperor Tiberius and the words Tiberius Caesar Augustus, son of the divine Augustus. And to his question, "Whose head is this and whose inscription?" they could not but answer, "Caesar's." And with his answer, Jesus silenced them.
There are two elements here, an immediate element and a profounder. Caesar was the ruler, hated but legitimate, of Palestine. Even the Pharisees had asked for a Roman procurator instead of the murderous Archelaus. That was the answer to the question actually asked. But the words go far deeper. Caesar has powers, of course. He can take what he wants. But now we hear from the words of the man who was God that Caesar has rights. Whatever the civil authority requires for the proper conduct of society, to that it has a right. Christ says so. In the truest sense, therefore, it is a divine right. And this our Lord could say just a few days before Caesar crucified him.
The stand Jesus took, comments a modern Bible scholar, helped to direct the early Christian communities not to take up anarchical positions, as we read in St. Paul's letter to the Romans.
You must obey the governing authorities. Since all government comes from God, the civil authorities were appointed by God. And so anyone who resists authority is rebelling against God's decision, and such an act is bound to be punished. If you want to live without being afraid of authority, you must live honestly, and authority may even honor you. The state is there to serve God for your benefit. The authorities are there to serve God. You must obey, therefore, not only because you are afraid of being punished, but also for conscience' sake. This is also the reason why you must pay taxes, since all government officials are God's officers. They serve God by collecting taxes. Pay every government official what he has a right to ask, whether it be direct tax or indirect, fear or honor.
When I read this gospel, however, my mind went immediately to another episode, also regarding the payment of a tribute or tax, and to a painting considered one of the greatest masterpieces of all time. In the year 1424, a young man of 22 was commissioned by a certain Brancacci to decorate part of a private chapel in the Church of the Carmine in Florence. Though his name was Tommaso, or Thomas, he has always been known as Masaccio, or Slovenly Tom, for his careless way of dressing and his lack of interest in money or possessions. The subject of the painting was to be incidents in the life of St. Peter, including the finding of the tribute money, which, comments one writer, was an unemotional scene hitherto rarely depicted. The incident took place in Capernaum, where Jesus and Peter arrived together after the Transfiguration, and before our Lord's definitive departure for Judea. The only evangelist to record it is Matthew, hardly surprisingly, for as a former tax collector he was particularly up in financial and tax matters, writes Piero Bargellini.
Because of his old profession, he knew very well that 2 months before the Passover, the collection would begin in every community in Palestine of the tax that every Israelite over 20 had to pay towards temple worship.
The tax originated in the Law of Moses, which provided that every adult male should make a small payment each year for the building of the tabernacle for the Ark of the Covenant. In time, it became a contribution to what has been described as the enormous expenses of the daily sacrifice and other offices in the temple at Jerusalem. The Jerusalem Bible, in the Book of Exodus, refers to it as a poll tax, payable when a census was made.
Everyone subject to the census must pay half a shekel, and this half shekel shall be set aside for Yahweh, the ransom for your lives.
In the Greek text of the New Testament, scholars tell us, the word didrachma is used, that is, 2 drachmae, but the tax was paid in Hebrew currency, which, we're told, is why there were money changers in the temple. The fact that Jesus paid the tax both for himself and for Peter, writes Sheed, looks as though he were definitely emphasising a special relationship between himself and Peter, who was to be head of the church upon earth after Christ. And the painting by Masaccio? It's a fresco cycle in 3 parts. In the centre, the taxman is demanding payment of the poll tax from our Lord and the apostles. Jesus turns to Peter and tells him to find the coin in the mouth of the fish. On the left, in the background, Peter is bending down to catch the fish. On the right, in the foreground, Peter, with an air of mingled dignity and contempt, writes one critic, is handing the coin to the tax collector. Masaccio died at the age of 27, but, we read, in his short life, he brought about a revolution in the dramatic and realistic representation of biblical events. He concentrated on the drama of the situation. The gestures and groupings of the figures were used to describe the action. Giorgio Vasari, in his Lives of the Artists, points out that Masaccio himself appears as one of the apostles.
In a self-portrait, which Masaccio executed so skillfully with the help of a mirror that it seems to breathe, we're shown the bold way in which St. Peter is questioning our Lord, and the attentiveness of the apostles as they stand in various attitudes around Christ, waiting for his decision, with such animated gestures that they look truly alive. St. Peter is especially remarkable as he flushes with the effort he is making in bending to take the money out from the belly of the fish, and even more when he pays the tribute, where we can see his emotion as he counts the money and the greed of the man who's receiving it and is looking at it in his hand with great satisfaction.
Vasari was writing in the late 1600s, but a 20th century critic, equally enthusiastic, adds his own interpretation.
Masaccio has formed a group of potent and formidable individuals. These simple men are fit to shake a world. He has shown them in a moment in which discouragement and determination blend. The technicality threatens to check the salvation of the world. He has discriminated between the assured authority of the Christ and the wrathful energy of St. Peter. He has invested the majestic forms with massive draperies, grandly disposed in simple folds. He has given even the tax gatherer the grace of a Roman athlete.
When I took a friend to see the Masaccio frescoes, only a limited number of visitors were allowed into the Brancacci Chapel at one time. For some years, it had been closed for restoration. But the flow of admirers is by no means a recent phenomenon. Witness the words of Vasari, written 450 years ago.
Because of Masaccio's work, the Brancacci Chapel has been visited from that time to this by an endless stream of students and masters.
No further comment needed. And what about that fish that Peter drew out of the lake at Christ's command? H.V. Morton, tireless traveller and investigator of scriptural happenings, explains that the musht, or combfish, is the characteristic fish of the Lake of Galilee.
In the Lake of Galilee, there's a kind of fish which keeps small objects in appropriate pockets, but the sense of the story goes way beyond this touch of folklore.
Always the scholarly rein on our flights of fancy. A more scientific note comes from Aristotle, who, in his Historia Animalium, written around 344 BC, tells us this.
Flatfish go to sleep in the sand, and they can be distinguished by the outlines of their shapes in the sand, and are caught in this position by being speared with pronged instruments.
I wonder what Peter used.